I'm John Kroll. Coming up on No Limits, we will tackle the public health challenges confronting the state of Indiana. We'll discuss how prepared Hoosiers are to deal with the beginning of cold and flu season, and what other threats are out there. We'll talk about the things both the state and its citizens could do to get better prepared. We'll talk about all of this with doctors, public health officials, and you. I encourage you to join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending us comments and questions via Twitter and Facebook at WFYI. We look forward to talking with you. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today about issues confronting public health here in the state of Indiana, and I'm delighted to say that we have as our guests Dr. Virginia Kane, Marion County Health Director. Welcome, Virginia. Good to have you here.
Nice to have you. Thank you.
Dr. Greg Wilson, Associate Chair for Community and Global Health, Department of Public Health, the IU School of Medicine, and a former state health commissioner. Good to have you here.
Very nice to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. And Dr. Sean Grannis, who is the research scientist at Regenstrief Institute, IU School of Medicine, Health Information Exchange. Those are mouthfuls of titles, but we're glad to have you all here. I also would like to invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, sending us emails, questions by email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending your comments or questions via Twitter and Facebook at WFYI. Well, we're right on the edge of cold and flu season, and I guess the question we should start with, and I'll direct this one first to Dr. Kane. How prepared is the state? Are we ready for it this year? And if not, what things should we do to be ready?
I'd like to think that the state is ready. I think we've this state health commissioner that's sitting next to me did a great job of planning with, I think, most of the local health departments and all the hospital and providers. So I think we'll be in good stead in terms of being prepared for the flu, and I think we had a great practice run with the H1N1 epidemic that we saw last year. So, really enhanced our efforts.
Well, and that's sort of the jump off. Last year at this time, people in the state were almost on the edge of panic when they were talking about H1N1. Mm-hmm. You know, in some ways we could talk about the change in the culture. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen people change their behavior so quickly, and that you stopped coughing into your hand almost overnight and started mm-hmm. doing the vampire cough mm-hmm. Into your elbow. So is H1N1 no longer really a threat?
I mean, I think what had happened for us, because it was such an unknown virus, mm-hmm. There was a lot of concerns from a lot of the experts and the federal government that this particular influenza strain was going to be so deadly and leaving us with a lot of deaths or if notwithstanding that, a lot of morbidity or severity in terms of complications related to the influenza. We're delighted to say that that did not happen, this particular new strain, but it also... it did identify that if we had had a deadly strain, I think we did a pretty good job of being very well prepared and sort of addressing most of our gaps that we needed to strengthen, along with communication and the logistics of getting the vaccine out. So I think that's very important. So if we ever have a bioterrorism event, or let's just say, for example, you know, we got Super Bowl coming in 2012, hmm. Are we prepared to handle something if we had huge mass casualties? Could we do it?
Dr. Wilson, what were the lessons learned from the H1N1?
I think over the last 10 years, there's been a dramatic improvement in both the state and county health departments in their ability to meet any crisis. The bioterrorism threats in the early 2000s really gave us a heads up that our public health system wasn't ready to deal with those crises. And with a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of effort on both the state and county health departments, I think this infrastructure is much stronger now. And last year, as Dr. Kane said, was a trial run for both the state and the counties to put their communication networks in place to test some of the structures that had been built over the last 8 to 10 years. And we found they worked. And those delivery mechanisms, the communication networks, the ability to rapidly move vaccine to where it was needed to respond to the needs of the population, fortunately, was very successful. So I think we feel much more comfortable with this year's flu season for several reasons. One is that the structure's there, we know it will work. And also, as Dr. Kane said, we know the H1N1 is not as virulent, it's not as deadly as we had planned.
As the fears were. Right. Well, I want to talk a little bit. I'm going to ask our listeners to join us by calling 866-476-3881 or sending us emails at nolimits@wfyi.org. But I also would like to follow up and just ask a quick question. What changes did we make here that worked? And I'll direct that one to Dr. Sean Grannis.
Sure. So I think I would start by saying Indiana is unique in a lot of ways in public health, but I would start by saying Indiana has fostered a great deal of collaboration and partnership between local and state agencies and have built a framework, a communication network that allows what we call in the business bidirectional communication, meaning that local public health can communicate with state public health, and the clinical community is also involved in this communication loop. So what have we done? Indiana has one of the most advanced technical infrastructures to facilitate public health being able to understand what's going on in the community and feed that information to the appropriate stakeholders, the right information at the right time, and include clinical health care in the picture. Traditionally, public health has done a very good job of gathering data and acting on that data, but they've also in Indiana shown that you can do a better job of gathering more comprehensive, timely data by developing appropriate strategic infrastructure to do so.
Were there changes in the law that had to be made to do this, or why hadn't it been done before? Leading up to this,
I think for a variety of reasons, and Dr. Wilson and Dr. Kane may want to add to this as well. I think there was an acute awareness in 2001 with the anthrax outbreak mm-hmm. that made us all aware that bioterrorism was a real possibility and that we needed an infrastructure that was lacking at the time to provide that. And so I think there was an acute awareness at that time, and there certainly were. We needed to ensure that the appropriate rules and regulations were in place to facilitate that infrastructure.
So, Sean, yeah. You know, because I just want to put it a little bit more in layman's terms,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
You know, the mumbo-jumbo
yeah.
kind of
yeah.
stuff that you added. But,
yeah.
You know, most people, I think, take this for granted. But this is the first time almost nationwide that we were able to get a message out in real time. I mean, in less than 5 minutes, where we can send a message electronically mm-hmm. to almost every provider, not only in Marion County, but central Indiana. So if I had something quickly I needed to get out, you know, in the past, a lot of times I might have to wait till the 6 o'clock news to get the message out to my providers or the public. But to all the hospitals and all the providers, I could get key health information out to them through his electronic network system, and that's huge. I don't think there's any other city that did it in that manner the way we've done it. And we're one of the most wired,
right.
electronically wired cities in the country.
Well, when we talk about electronically wired. What, how does that system work? And I'll reiterate Dr. Kane's point here. If we can reduce it to layman's, as the only non-medical professional on the program right now.
Sure.
If I understand it, other people might.
Healthcare generally generates data everywhere. Physicians have to be able to receive data from the fax machine, from the courier, from 15 different electronic applications. Indiana, the Regenstrief Institute and the Indiana Health Information Exchange has developed what's called a clinical messaging application. It's one way that physicians can receive all of the information they need. So clinical data, laboratory results, transcriptions were delivered long before public health information was delivered through the system. A couple of years ago, with funding from the CDC, what we did is we said, I should be able, just like I send a discharge summary to my physician, I should be able to send something from public health to my physician. And so, to Dr. Kane's point, when we discovered something new about H1N1 that needed to be communicated today, not in 3 days when I could put together three staff members to stuff 3,000 envelopes and get it in the mail, but today, now, we could do that, and we can do that today. If there's an immediate need to reach out to the physicians in central Indiana and across the state, we can do that immediately.
So reducing this, are you communicating via email? Are you tweeting? Are you... you're nodding your head up and down, which I'm guessing means you're doing all of that.
Well, we're delivering information in the way physicians receive information today. It's electronically, but we have to be flexible in doing that. There's a big push today. Believe it or not, most physicians don't have electronic medical record systems today. And so we push data electronically to physicians who do have it. We create a web-based portal where physicians can log in and get information. But we also, believe it or not, still have to fax a lot of information to physicians today. So we push data to physicians in whatever fashion they're able to receive it. And that's one of the key points. It's not a one-size-fits-all. We will push it in any way, shape, or form they need to. Docs aren't checking Twitter during the day when they're seeing their 40 patients.
Okay, well, let me toss this back to Dr. Greg Wilson here and ask, what is the resistance to electronic record keeping by physicians?
It's primarily financial, and I think the estimates have been up to $25,000 or more per physician's office just to wire a system to allow them to put electronic medical records. And there's no one who reimburses for that. The insurance companies are not going to pay a physician more. They've got an electronic medical record system, and so that has to be figured into the overhead cost. There's also the time, the expertise, the technical resources that you need to put that in place. The other thing is that the communication between that electronic medical record system has to be very close with the billing system because physicians have to be able to take that data and transport it into a billing system. Up to now, many of the billing systems don't talk to our electronic medical record systems, and so physicians end up doing double entry just to put that information into a billing system. And so there's been not so much resistance, but just a lot of obstacles for physicians to move to what we call EMRs or electronic medical records systems in their office.
So it's primarily a financial thing. And are there any, real quickly, we've got about a minute before the break, are there privacy concerns or anything like that with electronic medical records at all?
Sure. So on the heels of your previous questions, I don't think privacy concerns are a barrier for physicians to adopt. To Greg's point, I think it's largely value that they're missing today. Why should I do this? Why should I, when I see my partners who install these EMRs, they're working till 10 o'clock at night getting information into the EMR when before I could get home at 6?
Yeah, I can hire new staff with this or whatever, spend the money in different ways. This fascinating conversation, I'd invite our listeners to join it by calling 1-866-476-3881 or emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. We're going to take a short break to thank the people who've made this program possible. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by your membership and by Terry Lee Honda, offering direct access to Terry Lee every day. TLC is the Terry Lee Commitment. Terry Lee Honda, new in Avon on U.S. Highway 36. More at terryleehonda.com. And by the Indianapolis Opera's production of Gilbert and Sullivan's comic opera, The Mikado, October 15th and 17th. Tickets are available at indieopera.org. Help kick off the Fall Radio membership campaign with a pledge during Silent Web Week at WFYI.org. Pledge online now through Sunday to automatically be entered for a chance to win an Apple iPad. More information is at WFYI.org. You're tuned to No Limits here on 90.1 FM. Fresh air is up this evening at 7 o'clock.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are joined today by Dr. Virginia Kane, Marion County Health Director, Dr. Greg Wilson, Associate Chair for Community and Global Health, Department of Public Health, IU School of Medicine, also a former State Health Commissioner, and Dr. Sean Granis of the Regan Streiff Institute. He's a research scientist there at the IU School of Medicine and Health Information Exchange. Thank you for being with us today. We're having a fascinating conversation about how we've prepared for basically the public health issues and how the infrastructure has been greatly enhanced over the past few years. I suppose this is perhaps the only benefit we can say came from the anthrax threat of 2001. What I'd like to talk about a little bit now is What health threats are facing Hoosiers right now? What should they be concerned about, and what should we be doing to prepare for them? Dr. Wilson, I think I'll throw that one to you first.
I think I'd start by saying that the biggest health threat that I can see is not a disease or a disorder. It's really the lack of infrastructure that we have still in the public health system, and primarily the lack of public health professionals. Indiana has less than half the number of public health professionals that most states per capita would have. So that's kind of like the Colts putting five players on the field and expecting them to stop every play. It's no matter how capable our public health departments are, county or state, they just need more resources. And over the years, we've cut those resources a little at a time. But Indiana now is less than half of the national average, and a third of those individuals are ready to retire in the next 5 to 7 years. We're going to have a major crisis in workforce, and I think that's going to be the major problem that we face in Indiana.
Are there steps being taken to deal with it, or are they
We do. Indiana University has announced that they'll be forming two schools of public health, one in Bloomington and one here in Indianapolis. Over the years, that will help replenish the number of public health professionals we have available in the state. But at the same time, you know, both state and county governments have to realize that we need the financial support to hire those individuals to reconstitute a public health infrastructure. And I can say this for Virginia because it's politically sensitive, but we may face a crisis here in the next few years. Some of the things that we take for granted, immunization clinics, inspection of restaurants, some of the public health issues that we assume are being taken care of may begin to falter. We may not be able to meet all those needs of the community. And you never realize that until you reach a crisis.
So, Greg, what was that percentage of, you know, there's a certain percentage of public health professionals that you're supposed to have based on your patient population. Would you want to talk about that? And how does Indiana compare to the nation?
Well, the last workforce analysis done by the federal government showed that the average number of public health professionals in the country is somewhere around 128 per 100,000. Indiana has 46 public health professionals per 100,000. Even in
so
the
that's
Midwest.
About a third.
About a third.
Put it in context,
right.
A little above a third.
A little above a third. Even in the Midwest, although it's lower, it's still 76 per 100,000. So compared to the rest of the states in the Midwest, we're significantly lower. Also, we're the only state in the immediate surrounding Midwest that does not have a school of public health. So every state around us has a school of public health, and Kentucky has two schools of public health. So again, if you don't educate public health professionals, if you have people having to leave the state to get their education, then you're going to see your workforce diminish.
What kind of, if I could step in real quickly, and I'll take whoever signals me on this one, what sort of public investment from state and local governments would we be talking about to get to, let's just say, the Midwest average of 76? How much money are we talking about here? I notice there's silence here, so which doesn't work well on radio, guys. So I'll fill in for a moment while you collect your breath and decide whether you want to really give us the number or not.
I think there are two issues. Okay. I think there's the issues of we don't have enough public health professionals that we're producing. Mm-hmm. So that means you have to have a robust school of public health.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to start too, but how robust will they be? And will they have the necessary resources in order to sustain themselves? I think that's really critical. I think
there's a kind of social contract thing going on too. I mean, if we're going to educate these people to do the work, and then we don't have any work for them, it's going to fail too.
And that's the second phase. That's the key piece that I want to really emphasize, and that is we have 92 counties, and our infrastructure for our local public health departments are not where they need to be. And we really need to have more resources so that we can hire more staff. So say, you know, one of our counties, we had a chickenpox outbreak, you know. Who provides those immunizations for those school-based clinic kids? So, like, we just got this new law in May that states we have to almost immunize every kid from kindergarten through 12th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And we're required to do that in a 2.5-month period, where traditionally we only had to do maybe like a third of those students in a 12-month period. So the public looks to a lot of the local health departments to provide those immunizations. Now, we have a lot of providers. Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you have insurance, the typical mom, the average cost of the immunizations for this child, meningococcal vaccine is $100. Mm-hmm. The chickenpox vaccine is $80. Heaven forbid, if I'm a mom and I've got more than one child that's going between kindergarten and 12th grade, and I may have to come up with like $600 to get my child vaccinated. But when you can go through a local health department, that charge is going to be $10. If they participate in our mass clinics, it's free. So then you see all of, and you know we got way more than 200,000 children in Marion County that you have to try to immunize in a 2.5-month period. So we really, our surrounding counties and counties throughout the state, we need to have the infrastructure in order to provide these services. And yet, there are a lot of local barriers that are put in place that you can't even pay a nurse more than $25,000. So what's the chance that you can recruit a nurse? It's okay for her to make $35,000 or $40,000 in a hospital, but it's not all right for her to make more than $25,000 in a local health department. So we got to get rid of these obstacles, you know, because we have life-threatening illnesses that we're facing, and we got to work. We need our legislators to work towards making those correct adjustments.
Well, and I think we can talk a little bit about sort of the numbers involved and the financing of this. Right now, though, we've got a caller who's been very, very patient, and I'd like to bring him in. I'd like to invite others to join us by calling 866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or sending comments via Twitter or Facebook at WFYI. George, are you with us?
I am.
Thank you for hanging in there. George is calling from Indianapolis. You have a question for us.
Yes, I do. And I know that I've heard Dr. Kane speak about this before, and I know that she's a strong advocate here. I've been reading recently that about 1 in 5 medical visits has a behavioral health, substance abuse, and mental health component. I also know that about 1 in 10 folks with addictive disorders ever receive any services, and that people with addictions and mental health who appear in acute states at emergency departments are more likely to end up being actually admitted to the hospital, to a med bed. And just some concerns about what's being done to increase the identification. And part of this is on a national health, we talk about the medical home. What's being done in primary care or in the public health setting to increase identification and reduce some of the barriers, not only to treatment, but even billing and payment for mental health and addictive disorders?
Good question. Thank you for sharing that. I will take the answer offline, but thank you for joining the program.
Please. Is it offline? I mean,
No, you're on.
Okay.
You're on.
One of the key things, I think, you know, the caller, you've really hit it on the nail for a lot of our issues, you know. So some of our major health outcomes, you know, if people are depressed, they're not going to be compliant with their medications. They're not going to take their medications. So how do we identify those people who I'm coming in complaining of abdominal pain when in reality it may be a mental health issue? And they just didn't know how to see it or felt uncomfortable about seeing it. But we do have to have better screening tools, and we have to have our primary care providers doing those screening tests. So I know that the health department with our local mental health association has partnered with a number of the primary care providers to introduce screenings. We did that at the Wishart Hospital in our primary care, actually doing screenings of our young patients in terms of depression and other mental health issues. And we were kind of surprised, shocked, to find the number of people who have needs from a mental health standpoint, just depression alone. And with this economic crisis that we're seeing, it really sort of highlights those issues and try to bring it a little bit more to the forefront.
Yeah, Dr. Grannis, Sean Grannis, I saw you nodding your head emphatically there, so I figured you had a point you wanted to make.
Sure, absolutely. And George asked, you know, I think how do we do a better job of identifying, getting the services these patients need? We've built infrastructure, as we've talked about before, that helps us to identify things like a person who's been infected with a very infectious bacteria like methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Hospitals need to quarantine that person.
And what is that? Yeah.
Methicillin-resistant Staph aureus is a bacteria that is resistant to many antibiotics. Its infection rate is on the rise. Okay. And in order to treat it, we need to quarantine these individuals when they're in the healthcare system. We've built a system across central Indiana that alerts hospitals when patients with that known infection arrive so that we can immediately quarantine them. I use this example not to say we need to quarantine mental health patients, but to say we need to be able to identify individuals with those types of conditions so we can provide them with the services. Unfortunately, there's often a catch-22 in policy that prevents sharing of this admittedly very sensitive information. And so we often make our job doubly hard.
What's the catch-22?
The catch-22 is many people suffer from mental health illnesses,
mm-hmm.
So we need to protect that information and make it harder to share who has the illness to actually allow them to
and
receive the care.
Presumably because there's a stigma attached.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
So there are two things. So we have really got to address with our employees, our companies, and our corporations and the general public about the stigma related to substance abuse and mental health. We've got to get rid of that stigma, and we've got to realize that we've got viable people. It's just like if I had a heart problem my blood pressure is high, and I knew if I took my medications, I'd have normal blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So for a lot of our mental health issues, they may have a deficiency in a special neurotransmitter or some kind of enzyme that we have, and if they took their medications, they're viable to do the work, maybe even better than us who are not on any medication. So we've got to get rid of the stigma so people are way more comfortable. For our folks who unfortunately are addicted, substance abuse, we have to have treatment on demand. We need resources. So if I got a problem and I want to get help, I can't wait 2 months to finally get into a drug treatment program because I don't have the money or I can't get these services outpatient. So we really have to work harder in getting our message out.
I'd like to invite, if I could real quickly, I'd like to invite our listeners to join us by calling at 866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. We're talking, obviously, about public health challenges right now, and our caller, George, asked a question really about substance behavioral issues and the challenges there. Dr. Greg Wilson, you were had a point you wanted to make.
As often we think of mental health issues just affecting adults, but there are definite ramifications for the child. Take postpartum depression, problems with parenting that lead to child abuse. We need resources, as Dr. Kane said, to allow parents, individuals who are having difficulty with the adjusting to new infants in the home, to get help. We need insurance and governmental policies that provide these resources. And it can make a major difference in the long-term outcome of that child. So,
don't let me go here. You may not want to hear it. I think
the name of the show is No
anybody
Limit.
Does,
you can go
anybody that does bullying, they got a behavioral problem. We might as well label it like it is. They got a behavioral problem. Bullying, you know, our children. So there's so many things we need to start addressing, whether you're an adolescent or an adult. There are a lot of issues that go along the spectrum.
Well, we can just get started on this before the break, but I think we ought to talk a little bit about what some of the obstacles are there, what blocks people from wanting to deal with this. Some of it's financial. I mean, I asked the question about how much would it cost just to get us, and there was a noticeable reluctance among all of you to step up and give me a number, even a ballpark number. Mm-hmm. But there are other factors in place, too. Mm-hmm. And I think this might take us into a conversation where we're talking a little bit, too, about what the proper role of government is when it comes to dealing with health and public health issues. So could we talk a little bit first about really what some of the obstacles are other than financial? We'll pick that up on the other side of the break. What are some of the obstacles? Dr. Kane, would you mind getting us started? You're the one nodding the most emphatically.
I see other folks going. Oh, oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know we were going into a break.
No. We've got a couple of minutes. So.
I'll be honest with you. I think the biggest problem is that it's our lack of education for our general public as well as our legislators. And I think if people really understood the problem, so that means that we've got to work harder in communicating to folks the realities and to get rid of those myths and those stigmas related about the diseases that we're facing, that I think we could have more advocates and more support for the resources that we need in order to address these problems.
Dr. Granis, do you agree?
I do agree, and I think so. Education and awareness of the consequences of unaddressed or untreated illness are profound. There's lost wages, lost productivity. There's child abuse, as Dr. Wilson has alluded to, and I think folks are unaware of this. As I'm a family physician as well, and much of my time is spent treating mental illness in the clinic, and there are a profound number of individuals who would rather not be treated for the stigma attached rather than recognizing that this is part of the human condition.
And let's talk about one other aspect. I'll go to the aspect of substance abuse. I think if you looked at the individuals that we have in our local correctional facilities in our state, definitely the local correctional facilities, you may find as high as 60% of those arrests or people incarcerated, it may have something related to illicit substance abuse. So if I could handle this from a medical standpoint and I could treat these individuals, how many people would be filling those vacant spots in our local facilities? But we also don't want individuals out there that may exhibit some violent behavior or behavior that can result in injury.
Yes, we need to take a break right now. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
Limits is made possible by your membership and by Butler University's Seminar on Religion and World Civilization, presenting a discussion on peace and conflict, the future of Islam, with Resla Aslan, scholar of religions and a contributing editor at the Daily Beast, Tuesday evening, October 26th at 7 at Clues Memorial Hall. Information at butler.edu. And by Studio Showcase, celebrating its 16th year with over 30 local artists and a home gallery setting, featuring jewelry, ceramics, photography, and more. Tonight, beginning at 5, info at studioshowcaseart.com. And by the Zionsville Autumn Artscape, an outdoor arts fair featuring artists, live music, food, and drinks. This Saturday from 10 to 5 in downtown Zionsville. Information is available at ZionsvilleChamber.org. You're tuned to No Limits here on WFYI 90.1 FM for your information. Fresh Air is up this evening at 7 o'clock. To listen to WFYI Radio online, tune in at WFYI.org/radio.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are joined today by Dr. Virginia Kane, Marion County Health Director, Dr. Greg Wilson, Associate Chair for Community and Global Health, Department of Public Health, the IU School of Medicine, and a former State Health Commissioner, and Dr. Sean Granis, who is a research scientist at Regan Streiff Institute, IU School of Medicine, Health Information Exchange. We're starting to stack up tweets and Facebook comments and emails, and we're going to get to those in a second. But, Dr. Wilson, you had a point you wanted to make about basically mental health for children.
Yeah, we were talking about mental health before the break. And from perspective of children, there's a major shortage of child psychiatrists and psychologists in the state. We just don't have any place to refer children for counseling. You have a three-year-old who has aggressive behavior, who's out of control. That can be managed if they have the proper counseling. But if they're, that's not addressed, then those children progress through the school system. They become more out of control as teenagers. And as Dr. Kane said, many of these individuals end up in trouble, in jail, with severe mental health problems in the long term. We just need to do a much better job of addressing those issues in Indiana.
Well, I'm going to take a couple of these questions now. We got one from an unidentified tweet that says, how do we pay for public health? Property taxes, income taxes, sales tax? Whom can we put pressure on to adequately fund public health? So I guess actually those are two questions. How do we pay for it first, and then we'll deal with the second one, who starts getting the phone calls after this program is over. So, Dr. Wilson, how about if we throw it back to you?
Yeah. Well, funding for state health departments are usually through the state government. County health departments are often through property tax and through local assessments. But I can tell you, during a recession, it's not a good time to ask for more money from the legislature. I think we all realize that. Once we get through the recession, we have to look at rebuilding this infrastructure that we've been whittling away at for really several decades. Mm-hmm. And, if we don't do that, then we actually lose money significantly as a state. As health commissioner, I had a number of instances where companies would come into the state, they'd look at our health outcomes, they'd look at the health indicators for our population, and they'd say, you have a state that's in the lower third for most health indicators, such as smoking. We're at the very bottom for rate of smoking, obesity, cancer deaths, so forth. And they would choose to move elsewhere. So that's a major, major dramatic impact on our economic system. GM, when I was in the health department, told me that they had the three most expensive plants in the country in Indiana for health care cost because of the health status mm-hmm. Of our population. So unless we address these public health issues, not only affects what services we can deliver through the mm-hmm. state and local government, but also the general economic status of our state. And so we pay for it that way also.
Well, if I could ask, like Dr. Kane, One of the questions that follows this up is which level of government is responsible for local health department infrastructure? You're the Marion County,
right.
Director of the Marion County
right.
Health Department. You know, in your case, where does your funding come from?
So I will tell you that 2/3 of my funding comes from property taxes.
Okay.
But at least 1/3 of my funding comes from the federal government and state dollars. And you have to understand, as the average resident here, every resident pays local taxes,
mm-hmm.
they pay state taxes, and they pay federal taxes. So I think this responsibility of all those three entities should be responsible for the health outcomes that are taking place in our local community. And our property taxes are insufficient to take care of what we need from a local standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we've been so aggressive trying to get, we get about $18 million aggressively from going after local foundation dollars, federal government grants, and state dollars in trying to bring the necessary resources to our community. If we just based it on our local property tax dollars, it'd be insufficient in order to carry out the things that we would need to do. And we've been really hit hard this year. We've lost way over $1 million related to state funds, as well as big hits by our federal government in terms of our funding. And, you know, our property taxes rates are a little bit low. And so these are tough times. But when Indiana ranks number one as smoking, we have high rates of obesity. I hate to say our infant mortality rates are going up. When we see this economic crisis that occurs for some of our residents, sometimes they delay going in to seek out health care because they say, oh, I can't afford this. I'm going to get this big whopping bill. It may mess up my credit.
Mm-hmm.
You know I need these services, but if I can't pay this bill, you know, then and if they send a collection folks after me, it's going to impact my credit. So I have to wait till I'm really, really sick.
Then it's the most expensive.
And then it's the most expensive.
Point to deal
and you
with
may
it.
Get so sick that now you require hospitalization, whereas you've come in early, yeah. I might have been able to prevent that.
Yeah. Well, and could I ask real quickly, and then I know Dr. Wilson also has a point here, and we've got more questions stacking up, so I'm going to try to get to those. But when you talked about the $18 million that you get from pursuing, you know, foundation funding aggressively, overall, what is the budget for the Marion County Health Department?
Our budget is about $50
million. $50
million,
so 18.
We get about $36 million from property taxes.
$36 million, and is the $18 million that you're talking about then part of the $50 million
yes,
you're
yes,
talking
definitely.
About? Uh-huh. Oh, so if that funding doesn't come through, then
we're dead in the water. I have to tell you that now. Okay.
All right.
So a lot of services and a lot of things will be cut, and so we pay for we get a significant amount of vaccine from the federal government through the state to us to help for indigent and disadvantaged patients, but it's not enough. We have to buy additional vaccine. And for these vaccines we just provided, for me to provide vaccine for 1,000 children now would have cost me $300,000 in the private sector. And right now we still have 20,000 children that I know of. I'm excluding the private and the parochial schools, but 20,000 children that are still without the necessary vaccinations that they're supposed to have required by state law. And I've got IPS, Pike Township, Washington Township, Decatur Township, a number of townships are going to start to exclude these children because they don't have the vaccinations.
Dr. Wilson, you had a point you wanted to make.
Yeah, this state health department also receives considerable amount of money from the federal government. But to get federal grants, the state has to demonstrate a commitment to these programs. So the state has to put in some money before the federal government will give additional funding. And Indiana is 49th in the country for state funding for public health. And so until the state government makes a commitment, a financial commitment to these public health programs, we're not going to get the federal dollars that really are our fair share.
And where has the obstacle been in getting the state funding?
I think it's just generally been the decrease in state allocations for state government in general and also to public health. So there have been 10% cuts to the state health department for several times over the last decade. So it's whittling away again at that infrastructure.
And let me ask a question. If we're looking at a $50 million, I'm sorry to pick on you, Dr. Virginia
Kane, right.
Marion County.
Okay.
But I want to get at the question, really, of what it would take to do this right. What kind of financial commitment? $50 million, it sounds like you're saying, pretty much just barely keeps you in the game.
It barely keeps us in. It barely
what
keeps us in
the game. What would it take to get you ahead of the curve? How much of a budget, and then from there you can back out.
Probably $75 million.
$75 million. So we'd be looking at a 50% increase.
And so I think people have to, and this is the piece you have to understand, because we're the big gorilla, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
When we provide our services, I have a significant number of people who cross county lines that come and utilize our services. So when we're giving immunizations to children, they come across the county lines in order to get their immunizations. So I'm serving more than just the folks in Marion County. Sometimes I serve folks in my surrounding counties.
So should this be dealt with at something other than a county level? I mean, should
you
we
know
have
what?
Regional cooperatives?
I think that it is so important. Because, you know, all of our health officers, we're all in this together. So any kind of way we can help each other out and get those needed services to the clients, we're always more than helping. And we're always more than happy in order to provide those services. Because sometimes the person is closer mm-hmm. to our clinics on their border than they are to where they have to go to receive their services in their county from their respective health department.
Yes, Dr. Sean Grannis, you had a point, and I think it's probably about the fact that, you know, a virus doesn't necessarily respect a geographic boundary and says, I'm not going to cross Marion County and go into Hamilton County or down to Johnson.
Well, that too is a good point.
Yeah.
What I, on this notion of cost, I would just say there is, I am a medical informatics research scientist. I've worked with Dr. Wilson and Dr. Kane on building the right technical infrastructure. And it is, if you would grant the premise that it's easy to build technology that actually makes things worse than better. One of the things that the Regensreif Institute does is study information technology in healthcare and public health. There's actually an emerging field of public health informatics that looks at improving process efficiency. So one of the things we've done in the state of Indiana, we have arguably the most advanced syndromic surveillance system in the state. We can monitor the disease burden across the state in emergency departments. And we do it for much less than what most other states are doing because we're reusing the same infrastructure that helps doctors take good care of their patients is also used for public health to better understand the population burden, get the word out to doctors for what they need to do. And so part of this cost savings, though it's not the only answer, mm-hmm. is doing better with what we've got and reusing and building on top of existing systems. And that's one of the primary reasons that the Regensreif Institute exists, is to figure out smarter, better technical solutions to this problem to help Marion County do things at a lower cost, to help the state provide services at a lower cost. Technology isn't the only answer, but technology is often a bad answer without a lot of thought and strategy involved.
Well, I'm figuring out how to connect the pieces. I'm wondering, and you know, we started at the beginning of this program by talking about why doctors didn't have a lot of their records electronically. I mean, is something as simple as are there tax credits out there to encourage doctors to do that? Is the tax incentives or the are
sure.
those in place, or are they or
there is yeah, there is beginning to be something like that, and there's something called the in President Obama's administration, they've created about $27 billion in stimulus money for health information technology. And they're incentivizing physicians to begin using electronic medical records. Over about 5 years, individual physicians can get about $42,000 if they implement the appropriate technology. Now, many are debating whether $42,000 distributed over 5 years is enough, but the federal government is beginning to investigate and contemplate what sort of incentives are necessary to get the right type of technology out into the healthcare and public health community.
Yes, Dr. Kane, you had a point.
I just want to emphasize one thing. One of the things that I think is so important here is that we do have a lot of strengths. And our strengths have to do with we have so many key critical organizations out there that are doing just a bang-up job. Otherwise, our numbers would look even worse. But when you have Smoke-Free Indy, you have the American Heart Association, you have American Cancer Society, even WFYI, you know, helping to get our message out.
Thank
Mid America, I have got to get that plug out.
Yeah,
Mid America, you know, that does the mental health chapter for mental health here. I mean, if it wasn't for all of these, and forgive me for missing some other organizations out there, but if it wasn't for these organizations out there helping to get that message out, you know, we wouldn't even be where we are. And I love the collaboration, and folks here, they love to collaborate, and that's been so beneficial for us.
We've just got about a minute left, and I would like to ask Dr. Wilson if you could talk real quickly. When you talk about the 10% budget cuts each year, what does that cost us along the way as a state?
It cost us key personnel within the state health department and in local health departments. It's the history, it's the expertise, because as you begin to not give raises to state employees or you begin to cut individuals, you lose critical programs. And you also, as I said, lose the opportunity to get critical federal funding.
What sort of programs have we lost because of it? Am I putting you on the spot?
Well,
can tell with Dr. Wilson's voice, we are in the middle of cough and cold season here. So,
yes. No, I think part of it is that we just don't have the number of chronic disease programs that most states do, simply because we haven't had the personnel to be able to invest in a variety of different programs, such as asthma, cancer, cardiovascular disease, obesity. We're running small programs.
Diabetes,
right. We're running small programs in all those areas where some individuals, some places have twice, three times that number of individuals.
So if I had more resources and more staff, it might take me 2 years to get someplace where it might, if I don't have that money, it may take me 5 to 8 years.
I'd like to thank my guests today. I feel like we could do another hour on this topic easily, if not two. Dr. Virginia Kane, who is the Marion County Health Director, thank you for being with us. Dr. Greg Wilson, Associate Chair for Community and Global Health, Department of Public Health, IU School of Medicine, and a former State Health Commissioner. And Dr. Sean Granis, who is a Research Scientist at Regenstrief Institute, IU School of Medicine, Health Information Exchange. I'm John Kroll, and I would like to invite you to join us again next week, next Thursday at noon here on WFYI 90.1 FM. We're going to be talking about public-private partnerships, and we'll discuss the ways they've shaped Indianapolis and Indiana and the issues they present when it comes to crafting public policy. Please join us next Thursday. Thank you for being with us today. I'm John Kroll. Take care.
Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Executive Director Mary Hartnett. Producer Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator Melissa Davis. Technical Producer Cedric Freeman. Board Engineers Matt Sosi and Josh Hamig. And Intern Savannah Rains. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits. And you can listen online at WFYI.org.